Okay. Well, good evening and welcome to Build. I hope you're enjoying the weather. And thanks for coming so late. This is amazing that we have this kind of turnout at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. We're going to talk about Casablanca. It's a project that we've been working on for a little while. It's an incubation project, which means that it's not shipping under a product license just yet. With me here, I'm Niklas Gustafsson, and with me here is Artur Laxberg. And we will do, mostly, we're going to try to introduce Casablanca to you by looking at code. So we're going to go through a lot of code. I'll start out by going through some of the concepts and the basics, and then we'll drive most of it using some samples and some walkthroughs of what we're trying to accomplish. So first of all, I want to just set the context by looking at the Azure Developer Portal. If you go to Azure.net or WindowsAzure.com and you click on the Developer tab, you'll see this page. And there's a whole bunch of languages missing there. No, there's a whole bunch of languages up there. There's one notable language missing. And Casablanca is kind of about putting C++ up there on that list. So that's what we're overall what we're trying to accomplish with Casablanca. What we're doing to do that, and if we can switch back to the presentation here, what we're trying to do is we're trying to leverage C++, which has come a long way in the last, decade and a half, and it really is in so many ways a modern language with a new set of best practices, a new set of ways of doing things. And we need to update libraries, we need to update our methodologies to match what the language is today. We think that connecting applications to the cloud is important because the cloud really represents in so many ways a new architecture. It's fundamentally, you can assume nowadays that you have bandwidth available to you. It may cost, but you have it. You can fundamentally expect that your data that's stored in the cloud will be there and it will be reachable from anywhere pretty much on the globe. And that changes how applications can be written and how they can be put together and how they can communicate with each other and share information with each other. And we don't think that C++ developers, for some reason, are exempt from that or shouldn't be part of that new architecture. And so we want to put a toolbox together to make developing those types of connected applications straightforward. And we're starting with some of the fundamentals. I want to go touch first on what's in Casablanca. We have a couple of communication libraries. That's kind of the fundamentals. Like, you should be able to do HTTP, you should be able to do TCP, WebSockets, and to perhaps a lesser extent, UDP. Those are all important communication protocols and transports. You need to deal with serialization. A lot of serialization has happened through XML, but JSON is an incredibly important format nowadays. We also want you to have access to higher level libraries to support Azure Storage, Azure Service Bus, and to host your services in the cloud, in Azure, easily, without having to go through other languages to sort of act as a shim around your C++ code. We also want to take the outcome or the output of what we're producing for Azure and make it available for on-premise hosting of services. There's a lot of uses of things in the cloud, but the same methodologies and the same design principles are also very valid for developing code for use on your own data, on your own network. So we're going to support on-premise hosting with Visual Studio integration. And the Visual Studio integration also, of course, applies to Azure. When we put Casablanca together, we had a couple of design principles in mind. One was that this needs to be modern, right? The C++11 power needs to be exploited. We need to give all that power to you so that your productivity can be, you know, the best that it can be using the language. It also needs to be cross-platform. And we think that's very important because one of the selling points or one of the reasons for choosing C++ in the first place, besides performance, is its cross-platform aspects. not 100% of your code is ever going to be cross-platform, but a large portion of it can be with C++. And we want to make sure that when you're writing code for Azure or writing code for the cloud in general, that that can work on the phone, that can work on Windows, it can work on other operating systems as well, such as Linux, for example. That power must be in there, in the libraries. We think that writing clients is incredibly important in C++, and those need to be performant, but they also need to be productive. It needs to be straightforward and easy to write clients that are responsive and behave like you would expect them to, with a minimum of ceremony around how you accomplish that. And writing service applications should also be, server-side applications or services should also be straightforward. It should be productive, and with C++, you don't really have to trade off performance and productivity as much as you perhaps had to do in the past. But it also needs to result in scalable services. You can't, wind up with something that is a beautiful piece of machinery and performs really well from a local perspective, but when you try to scale it out to 10,000 users or a million users, it suddenly falls over. It has to scale well. All right. So that's some of the design principles that we had in mind when we designed Casablanca. The architecture of Casablanca, just to give you sort of a picture, a visual of what is in here, and I'll get out of the way so we can see it. At the bottom, we have some platform components. We have Windows 7, we have Windows 8, and we don't support XP at the moment, but we may in the future. Linux is another platform that we are porting this to. It's not, we don't have that made available yet, but we are porting it to that. And then there are some APIs that we rely on, like WinHTTP, for example, for the HTTP communication underneath our surface area. PPL is a dev, something we're shipping in Visual Studio 2012 that gives us the composition model for all these asynchronous long latency operations. IO completion ports, HTTP sys on the server side for listening to HTTP requests or other components. Then on top of that, so these are all things that already exist down here in green. On top of that, we've been building some basic communication libraries, things that, isn't anything special. This is not exactly something that we're innovating in, right? But we're building them on the principle that they need to be cross-platform, they need to be work the same way on Windows 8 as they do on Windows 7 and on Linux, and they need to do the basic communication with HTTP, with TCP, WebSockets, and UDP. Now, we don't actually have all of these available on in the release that is available on MSDN today, but this is what we're planning on putting together. Now, on top of communication, we need serialization. Hello? And so the most important one for us right now that we have put in there is the JSON serializer. XML is an important format too, but there's lots of good XML libraries. And we wanted to put together a simple JSON library to use with Casablanca. Your services need to not just respond to requests, they also need to do something. And often they need to do access file I/O, they need to access databases perhaps. So we're doing some file I/O libraries that compose well with the network I/O that we're providing in the other in the libraries down below here, all based on PPL. And we'll take a look at what that looks like in a few moments. We have some miscellaneous classes like timers and so on and so forth. And then we imagine that within this framework, you will build further libraries. And things like Azure Storage and Azure Service Bus are then higher order libraries that we built on the components underneath here. So here, this layer is what's providing the cross-platform capabilities. So anything you build on top of that will also be cross-platform. And then we imagine that others, we're not going to do this, could build libraries for assets like Windows Live, Xbox Live. I think those are sort of being joined a little bit too. I don't really know that. Things like Bing Maps. You can imagine a whole plethora of horizontal type of features, identity or not identity. And then we have hosts. These are things that let your services run in a particular environment. We have a host for executing under IIS, and we have a host for just sitting on straight on the server operating system. And you can imagine that we have a Linux host, for example, too, et cetera, right? All right. So before we delve into the first example, I just want to briefly touch on PPL. I'm going to expect that you're all familiar with C++ 11 in general, so I'm not going to give you a tutorial on that. But I do want to just touch on a couple of things from PPL, because you may not all be familiar with it. The way asynchrony is represented in Casablanca is through tasks. Asynchrony is really important for scalability and for responsiveness. And the tasks are placeholders for data that will eventually be available. So in this case, for example, we can imagine an operation that takes a long time. And it produces an integer in the end. So we have a task of I as the result of this function. The task TI will eventually be filled in with a result, but the function will return without filling it in necessarily. All right? That's the basic notion. So the thread, we can give up the thread, and threads are very expensive objects. We can give up the thread while we're waiting for that operation to complete. All right, so that means that we continue to execute without that function really finishing. What we then do, we can either block on it, but blocking is bad because then we hold on to the thread, but we can hang on what we call a continuation, and that's really just a handler. In this case, we're expressing it as a C++ 11 lambda. And then this function, it's an inline function, like a lambda, it will be invoked when this task is filled in. So when the operation finishes, the task is filled, and our handler is invoked. Okay, that's all we need in terms of PPL to look at our first demo. And in that, we're going to build a first service with Casablanca. So Arthur, why don't you take us through that?
Sure. Thank you, Nicholas. So let's go ahead and create a new project in Visual Studio. We're going to choose File, New, Project, and choose the Casablanca Azure application as the type of the project. Next. After giving the project a name, I'm prompted to choose whether I want this project to be a web role or a worker role. In practical terms, the difference boils down to whether I want my service to run under the IIS or standalone. In our case, it doesn't matter, so I'm going to choose the default, which is the web role, and click Next. In this dialog, we need to choose some endpoints. Again, we only need just one, so I'm going to use the default, but change the default port to something else, such as 2000, and click Finish. In a couple of seconds, we're going to see a solution that contains three different projects. One is a project that contains the source files of the application with some boilerplate code. We'll have a project that contains the configuration for the web role. And finally, there is going to be a deployment project that is going to go away in a final product. This is our main project. This is the web role, the configuration project, and finally the deployment project. So I'm going to increase the font slightly. And I also need to add a couple of additional header files that we will need later in this demo and navigate to the entry point of the service.
Okay. So thank you, Arthur. Before we run this code, I'm just going to, and make some edits here, I'm just going to talk a little bit about what we're seeing. This uninitialized function here that we're seeing on line 30 is kind of like the main of a Casablanca service. That's whether you're running under IIS or the standalone host, that's where your service gets to initialize its state, whatever state it may have to hold, and get started. And this is going to be invoked before the Azure sets up all the routing logic, et cetera. So you have time to get things started before starting having to service requests. What we're going to do here is, well, we see here on line 38 that we're creating a listener. That's a Casablanca class. It's created from the address that we have configured for the service, and we saw how Arthur was doing that initially. And then we have these handlers here. The listener has a function called support in which you hook in listeners to HTTP methods. And therefore, what the wizard does for us is hook us up with the four basic HTTP methods, get, put, post, and delete. You can have any number of methods, but those are the common ones. So we see a handler here for each of get and put, and there's also one for post and delete, respectively further down. And what we're going to do is we're going to replace the get handler with one that reads a file with some HTML in it and sends it back to us. And we're going to use the asynchronous file IO library that we have to read the file, and we're going to use our HTTP, well, we're already seeing the listener here, but we're going to use the HTTP message class, which we're getting in as an HTTP request here, to send the data back. And it's very quite straightforward. The asynchronous file IO library has a function called openiStream. It takes a file name. We've hard-coded it to make it keep it simple. And then we're just waiting for that open process to finish. It could potentially take some time. When it finishes, we have one of these PPL tasks and one of its continuations here. And what all we do in the handler is we reply to the message on line 48 here, reply to the message, an OK status code. We tell the client what kind of data we're sending back, and then we're just supplying the stream by getting the stream out of the task. That's the dot get, what that does. Supplying the stream as the body of the message. Now, if this was a really huge file, the library would do all the chunking and all the logic to make the actual streaming of this data efficient, and it would all be asynchronous. Once we've replied, that process is going on in the background, and code can go back and service the next request here. So it's all being done asynchronously and efficiently. Why don't we run it?
Okay. So this is our source. I'm going into the browser and hit refresh. And that's what we're getting.
Okay. What we're going to do next here is we're going to change this just a little bit. We're going to do a little calculator. It's going to be able to do subtraction and addition. And we're going to start by changing the get handler to pull up a different HTML file, this case called form.html. It will have two entry fields on it, a submit button and a radio button for either add or subtract. And when we submit our request, we're going to come back into this post handler. And let's see what that looks like.
OK. Let's go ahead and start it again. Go back to the browser and refresh the window. So in this window, I'm going to add a couple of numbers, choose the addition, and hit submit. And that's the result that we're getting.
Very good.
The power of C++.
Power of C++, right in your hands there. I want to take a look at what the post code looks like, because it's a little bit different than the get. So get, we don't send data to the service. We get data from the service. In post, it's the opposite. Well, we could do both, right? In fact, we will be sending data and getting data. But the message coming in here on line 53 has a vector of bytes in it. So we extract that vector, and extracting a vector from a HTTP message could take some time. So it's another PPL task that we get back from it. So we hook on a handler. And what the handler does is it immediately turns around and turns the vector, the byte vector, into a string on line 58. And then we rely on this class that's in Casablanca called the URI tokenizer. What the browser will do is we'll take those three fields, the two numbers and the operation, it will put them together and it will format it to look like a query, an URI query, the thing that comes after the question mark, right? So the URI tokenizer is a class that we have designed to pull apart the pieces of a URI. And so we can rely on that to actually pull out the pieces of the query. So we just give it the query, which is the body of the message. And then we pull out number one, number two, and operation. Those are three arguments to the query. We figure out which operation we're interested in, and then we perform the operation, and then we format some HTML to send back. And again, we're relying on standard string streams, and we just put the result into the reply like that. Lots of overloads on replies to make life easy for us. Okay, I think that's enough for that demo. And let's switch to talk a little bit about some other Casablanca basics. Casablanca is about REST programming. The alternative to REST is SOAP, which is a lot more complex and requires a lot more tooling. And we may support that in the future too, but right now our focus is on REST services. REST is ubiquitous. You know, it's by far the most commonly used design for web services today. It is supported in all language environments that I can think of, maybe not COBOL, but it is certainly available everywhere. And we want to up it a little bit. We want to provide that with a modern C++ rather than a C or, you know, 20-year-old style libraries. And that's a very important aspect. I mentioned it earlier of Casablanca and of REST program is JSON. It is short for JavaScript Object Notation. It is the subset of JavaScript that is its object literal notation. And it has become sort of a lingua franca for REST services. It is extremely simple. There are only numbers, strings, booleans, objects, which are essentially records, and arrays. And there's also null values. But there's extremely simple. There's not all this XML tags and end tags. All that complicated stuff is not present at all. It has some limitations, but it is definitely very, very simple. And we support it directly in Casablanca. So we needed to see a little bit about REST and JSON to look at our next demo, which is going to be a blackjack game. Arthur, why don't you show us a little bit of that?
So in this demo, we are going to play the game of blackjack. This game contains two parts. The client of this game is implemented as a Windows Store application, and the backend of this game is a Casablanca service deployed somewhere in an Azure data center. All we know about it is its address. The idea behind this game is very simple. Imagine that I'm a gambler, and I walk into a casino and decide to join a table. I have $1,000 of funny money to start with, and I decide to play a couple hands against the dealer. So by clicking the deal button, I'm going to be given a couple of cards. Let's do that. In this case, I'm going to decide to hit again. And at this point, just because I feel a little adventurous, I'm going to hit. No, in fact, I already lost.
Okay.
Let's try again. Let's do again. Now, I still feel adventurous. I'm going to hit again. And at this, what should I do? Should I hit or should I stand? Stand?
Stay. All right. Stay.
Okay. Okay, now I won. Great. It's time for me to leave the table and give the control back to Nicholas.
Okay, yeah, so let's take a look at the code behind all this. I think we'll start with a client. And if anybody thinks that's a weird looking app, well, engineers, you know, developers developed it, not UI designers. So we're going to look at a couple of things. So we're just going to, again, focus on Casablanca here. I don't want to go into sort of Windows 8, you know, App Store applications and that aspect so much. But we're going to focus on the Casablanca parts. But they're obviously intertwined with a lot of the other stuff. So if we followed Arthur's steps through the application, he started by joining the table. When he clicked the join button, it actually had to go up to this Azure service. That's, you know, it is running in an Azure data center somewhere, and he sent it. Well, there was a request going over there. The player was added to the table, and the service sent back a request to, yeah, you can go ahead and place your bet right now. He then placed a bet, and he got some cards, and he clicked hit, right? And then at the end, he also exited and so on. So we're going to take a look at the join button and the hit and see what happens there. So when he first comes into the application, we haven't contacted the service yet. There was no need for that. The join button here, the join button handler, needs to collect a couple of pieces of information. The service address, which in this case wasn't hard-coded in the application. It was actually an entry we could have up in the, we could change it up in the app bar. And then the name of the player, because that's going to be shown underneath. And from the service address, we're going to create a client, an HTTP client. And we're going to be using that HTTP client for some time in this, for the whole session, in fact, until we leave the table. So that's going to be our mechanism for communicating with the service until we're done. So if we scroll down a little bit, we see the code collecting the name up there, and then here is where we grab the service address and form, use a URI builder class. That's another thing. We saw the tokenizer earlier. Now we're seeing the builder. It's kind of the dual of the tokenizer. It puts URIs together from pieces so that we don't have to do string concatenation in order to form the URI. So we use the server address to as a starting point of a URI. We add a dealer resources, some extra path parts, and then we create our client. And we store that in a instance variable because we're going to, as I said, we're going to be using that in later requests as well. Okay, we have at this point almost everything we need to make a request. What we do need in addition to that, we need a relative URI. We need a couple of pieces of data that are unique to request rather than to the client. One of them is the identity of the table. We just hard-coded that to one here. And the name of the player. Right? The dealer wants to know the name. So we put that together, and that becomes a relative URI that we send along with a request. We choose post as our method here. That's an application protocol that you can sort of, it's between the server and the service and the client what methods to use, but post is when you're adding new information, the typical one to use. And then we're doing something on line 349, and this is our request. It goes over the wire now, over to the data center somewhere in the United States. What we do after that is we capture the task context. This is a PPL thing. We will use that later to get back on the GUI thread with an absolute minimum of ceremony, right? Very, very little effort to get back on the UI thread, which can otherwise be, quite a bit of work. All right, so the request gives us a PPL task back because the requests are long running. They take a while. So we get the request back. When the request is filled, in other words, we have a response, then we get into this handler here on line 351. And we do some UI manipulation, and then we get the actual data out of the task. Because remember, a task is just a placeholder, so the actual data we have to pull out of the task in order to use it. All right? That's our response. And here we're going to pass that on to a function interpret response, which is going to update our UI. We'll take a look at that in just a little while. We call task.get inside an exception handler, because one of the results of a task could be an exception, and you want to be able to handle that somehow. You don't want your application to suddenly terminate because there was a network error, for example. So we deal with errors there. And then if we scroll down just a little bit longer, more, we'll see where we're passing in the context, the captured task context as a second parameter then. And that's all we have to do to get back on the UI thread when we are handling the response to the request. All right? Okay. We got some cards, and now we had to decide whether to hit or stand. And we decided to hit because we had, I think we had 9 or something at the first time. When we pressed that hit, we got into this hit button click handler. And it's remarkably similar to the previous handler. There are a couple of slight differences. We don't create a client because we have one already. We use a put instead of a post. That's because we're kind of modifying state here. We're going to, we're not adding new state, we're just modifying state. We have another parameter here. That's kind of our subcommand under put, which is that our request is to hit rather than stand, for example. Okay? Otherwise, it looks almost exactly like the previous method, including the call to interpret response later, farther down. We get the response. All responses are equal in this application, so we call interpret response. That's just going to update our UI for us. All right, let's take a look at interpret response and see what that does. It's just down here. First, we spend a couple of lines of code checking that we actually... Yes, go ahead.
When you built the query string up there, was there a reason why you used string stream rather than maybe URI builder? I don't know URI builder, I was just expected to.
Okay, can we scroll up to see that? So right here? We could have used a URI builder also.
Oh, okay.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. We should have, in fact, for pedagogical purposes. Okay. So what we do, we spend a couple of lines of code on error checking. We expect to have a positive result, in other words, an OK or created. Those are common positive responses in HTTP. And we expect our content to be JSON, right? If that's the case, if that's not the case, then we return at the end of line 413 there. But if it is the case that we have JSON and it was a positive response, then we extract the JSON. And that's just a function that we believe is so common that you're going to want to the JSON extracted and parsed for you that we put it directly on the response class itself. And that can take some time because this is data coming over the network. And when the whole JSON object is parsed and ready, this is not an incremental parser we have, then we get into this function, or this lambda here. And we call a second version of interpreter response that is getting the JSON value. And what we're going to see in this code is two ways of dealing with JSON data in Casablanca. One is to just say, well, I don't care about dealing with anything except the JSON value itself. It's good enough for me. I'm just going to go through that DOM, if you will, and just treat that as my data. Or I can take the JSON value and construct C++ objects that mean something in my application from it, treating the JSON as just a sort of a transit data format. And we'll see both things being used here. For example, at line 429, we're just capturing the array of players that are at the table. And we're on line 437, we're iterating through those elements. And that's just a JSON array. That's just JSON values directly, right? We're treating it as a DOM, if you will. On the other hand, if we look up a little bit higher up here, there's a from JSON. That's a static factory method. It could be a constructor also on this BJ put response class that takes a JSON value and pulls out the pieces of it and constructs a BJ put response class. Whatever that is, right? And it just does that by, from the object, we know that it has a status field, we know it has a data field, and so we're just pulling that out like that, all right? And typically you want also to serialize and deserialize symmetrically, so we have an ask.json, which we're gonna use on the server side, which we're actually about to switch to. We've seen the client, we saw creating HTTP clients, we saw using the client to send requests, we saw how PPL tasks are how we get things back from the service. We saw how you use PPL to get back on the GUI thread, and we saw how JSON is being leveraged to send data across in a very straightforward manner. On the server side, we're going to see some things that we that are familiar first. In fact, in the Black Tag Service CPP file, there's this there's the onInitialize function. And we, in this particular example, we're not seeing the get handler and the put handler and so on, because our service is actually stateful, has a little bit of state in it. And so we're using this blackjack dealer class that we initialize on line 63 to hold that state. And it's going to have the handlers, which is what we'll see in the other file here, dealer.cpp. Dealer.cpp has a couple of handlers. The two that we're going to look at, because we looked at the client side of it, is the post handler and the put handler. The post handler handles two types of requests. One is to add a table, and we didn't see that in the application. And the other one is to join a table. And what we see here is some pretty common code for REST applications. You get data typically, either you can get it in the body of a message, but you get data in the URI. It can have a bunch of parameters that identify the resource that you're trying to address, or in headers. In this case, we're getting it in the URI, and we're pulling it apart with this URI tokenizer that we've already seen. And then if we go down a little bit, because this first piece of code is about adding tables, so we don't care about that. If we scroll just a little bit more, we'll see how we're we pulled out the table identity with a tokenizer. We look for the table. If it exists, then we're good. Otherwise, we have to send a negative response back. If we go down a little bit more here, we simply use the table to make sure that it has enough capacity, because if it's full, then you have to tell the poor player that he has to go find another table. And then when everything is okay, we put together response, and here we see the S.json that I talked, which is the dual of the from JSON, of course, that we take this BJ put response object and put together an JSON value from it, and then we send that across as the body of our reply. Okay, a little bit farther down here, we'll find the put method, the put handler, which is very similar to the post handler. We use the tokenizer for starters. We use the tokenizer to pull apart the pieces of the relative URI, some interesting data in there, the table ID, and the request. So the request equals hit. Right, we're going to use that for dispatching later, and we do the same thing we did earlier. We look for the table in the hash table of tables that we have, if we go down a little bit, we'll see how we're then using the request string to dispatch right here. This is a very simple mechanism. You could probably come up with something more efficient if you wanted to, but it's good enough for our purposes. There's a couple of requests. You can bet, you can hit, you can insure, you can double, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the typical things that you do as a blackjack player. Okay, so that's the client side and the server side. Again, we saw repeated on the server side, the listener. We created that in the uninitialized method. We used the URI tokenizer, and we dispatched on after having pulled apart the data inside that URI. So if we switch back then to, if we switch back to some concepts before we go into the next piece of code. We looked at how you hook a handler. Yeah, that's a question.
Do you have any plans of adding routing for basically what you're describing there at dispatcher to the...
So right now the routing is only on path, and so we don't do any query-based routing at the moment. And that's something that we can think of adding, but right now we don't have any.
So you do have it on the path, though.
Yeah, you can absolutely, yes. We do have it on the path. So we could, for example, one version of the blackjack server. The question was, do we have any plans on adding routing? And we do have routing on the path. In another version of the blackjack server, each table has its own handler, for example. And so you don't have to do that table trick at all. Does that satisfy your curiosity there? Okay, great. Please remind me to repeat questions if I forget to do so, because it's not always easy to hear. All right, so we saw that handler, right? You have a slow operation, and you hang on a handler to when the operation finishes. Let's make it a little bit more complex. Let's say this thing that you do with I also takes time, right? So what do you do? What do you do then? Do you block? No. You return another slow operation. And if it returns a task, then this then will return a task. It will, in fact, return a proxy for that task. And when the task, inner task here, finishes, then the outer task finishes. So this allows us to chain these things together. And this is what we refer to as sequential composition. You're composing tasks together in sequence. It is not, these tasks run in the background, but they are sequenced, right? They're serialized. But it all happens taken care of by the library in the background. If you do this from the GUI thread, for example, the GUI thread never blocks. And if you do this on the server, you can be very wind up with very scalable code, because most of the time these operations do I/O, and I/O spends a lot of its time blocking in the kernel. Okay, that's sequential composition. We have another form of composition where instead of doing things one after another, we actually have two operations that are completely independent, except we need the result of both operations before we can go on. Okay, we call that parallel composition, and we have a construct called whenAll for that. And when all, no surprise, returns a PPL task, and you hang on a handler to then all, which gives you a tuple of the values that these tasks held. Okay. So now you have taken two operations and combined them. You can combine three and four and so on and so forth. You can have vectors of operations, or of tasks rather, and combine those into one operation. So with that, we'll switch to our next application, which is an image processing app. And Arthur will take us through that as well.
OK, thank you, Niklas. And in this demo, we are going to take a few pictures that I took earlier today at this conference and stitch them together into a panoramic image. So those are the images that I'm going to take. I'm going to open them. And again, like before, this is an application that has a front-end and the back-end part. The front-end is, of course, the Windows Store application. The back-end is a Casablanca service deployed in an Azure data center. So I'm going to select those images. And as soon as I click Stitch, those images will be uploaded to the Casablanca service, running an image stitching technology that was developed originally by the Microsoft Research and borrowed by us for the purpose of this demo. And I should say that this is an example of an operation that is often beneficial to perform in the cloud as opposed to a battery-operated device such as a phone or a tablet. So let's go ahead and click Stitch and see if it works. This application is also a good showcase for the PPL technology that allows us to not only harness the power of multiple cores, but also to seamlessly combine compute-intensive operations with I/O operations. There we go. The operation is completed. And the image has been uploaded to a public Azure blob. And notice how not only does this application stitch the images, it also makes some of the people on the picture disappear, such as this one. It really is a cutting-edge Microsoft Research technology. So with this, we can do a number of things. We can upload the image and tweet it. Let's go ahead and do that. Let's refresh. And now we can actually access it from the browser. Like this. There we go. Yep. OK.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, this keeps amazing me every time I see it. Yes, go ahead. The question.
So you are using the Casablanca core interchangeably on the server side and also on the client side, especially in the RT, right?
Yes.
So are these libraries split so that they are compatible for the RT?
Yeah, so the question was, we're using it on both the client and on the server side. And are the libraries split so that they're compatible with RT? In a physical sense, they're split. In the sense that we have a DLL that is RT compatible. It will pass WAC, for example, the Windows App Store compatibility kit. We also have a server and Windows 7 and Windows 8 desktop DLL that wouldn't, but is built on WinHTTP instead, for example. From a API surface area, they're identical. So two implementations, but one single API surface. Another question.
Can Casablanca WinRT version or desktop version work, for example, with SkyDriver REST API?
It can work with any REST API. So the question was, will it work with SkyDrive REST API? It can work with any REST API. We don't have any libraries built that raise the abstraction level for SkyDrive. We could build such, and we have thought about, either us or somebody else in Microsoft should build those, but Casablanca itself is just a REST library.
Because right now, when you look for the SkyDrive API, you have, there is C#, there is Java library, and you can use REST API for that.
Yeah. So we have thought about building that, but we're not sure that we're the right team to build that or not. It's one of these things that can be built with Casablanca. All right, so let's take a look at the code behind this. We're going to, again, look at the client side and the server side code. And I'm going to, I want to leave enough time at the end for questions, so I'm going to be a little bit, I'm going to sort of rush through some parts of this. Again, I want to focus on the Casablanca parts, not on the WinRT parts or the logic of the stitching, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, let's look at the client first, because that's where we started. So Arthur did, He selected a bunch of pictures. He hit stitch, and then he hit like upload to Twitter, right? Those were the kind of the three actions that he did. Selecting pictures had nothing to do with the service and nothing to do with Casablanca. Once he hits stitch, that's the first time we need to contact the service. And this service is running also in an Azure data center somewhere. And we get into this stitch photo button click handler. And we're going to do a couple of things. We're going to upload images one by one. And we're going to do, in fact, in parallel. And then we're going to wait for all of them to finish. And when they have all been uploaded, then we're going to send a request to the service to stitch them together. And when the stitching has happened, we will get a message back that gives us the URI of the finished image. OK, what does that look like? Well, we have an iterator here that goes over on line 50. We go over the images that were selected. And we create a task, upload image async here on line 157. We'll create a task that tells us when the upload is over. Right? It's essentially masking an HTTP request response. We put those tasks into a vector, and then we just go on. So all these uploads happen in parallel, boom, as much as bandwidth will allow you to do. We then call whenAll with the begin and end of the vector. So that gives us, you know, a task that will be finished or will complete when all of those uploads have finished. Okay, that's the power of whenAll. This is parallel composition. Now, when that is done, we'll then call the send request async function. This is the one that actually might be called something else, like stitch, but it will send the stitch request up. Let's take a look at upload and send request. Upload, what we do in upload is we create a task, and this is to get us off the UI thread. We don't want to block that, so we actually do all this work on a background thread. It's very straightforward to do. And once we get into the task, once we start the task, we build a request. And this could be a little bit more complex than the request we saw in the blackjack game, because we're going to use headers. So we actually create a request object, use a put method for the upload, and then we add a few headers. We set the body to the image. So the image is now the body of the message. That's all we have to do for that. And then we send a request. Boom, done. When the response comes back, we're in this handler, and we're not actually going to do anything. Remember, we want to wait for all the uploads to finish. So all we're doing as a response here, or handling the response, is log the fact that we did this. All right. When all of them finished, we finished the whenAll, and we call this send request async function. All right. What does that look like? It, again, does some WinRT stuff. It creates a, well, here's the WinRT stuff. It creates a request, adds some headers. It actually has a path that it needs to add. This is the identity. It's the path as the path here. So we use a URI builder like we saw earlier. And then we build a client from the URI request, from the URI, and send a request. The handler starts here. And here we're actually going to interact with Azure Storage. We haven't talked much about Azure Storage, but there are three kinds. There's blob storage, queue storage, and table storage. In this case, we're actually relying only on blob storage for our example, and we're going to be storing that final image in a blob. And so what we're doing here is we're creating a blob client that represents sort of the overall account, the namespace, if you will, of the blob storage, and then a folder or a container called public share. These are local objects. They're just sort of describing the, if you will, the upper part of the path. And then we, in another task, again, in the background here, we extract a string. Remember, the string is going to contain the name of the file in blob storage. We extract the string. We get the file name. We put together a URL of the whole image file, and we create a block blob. There are two kinds of blobs, and I'm not going to go into detail what they are, but anyway, this is a local object, and we use that to actually get the data of the blog, which is the image, the stitched together image. When that data is available, and this is something that could take, you know, a few milliseconds because it's a big file and it's, you know, we're in a data center somewhere in the world, we get into this handler with a cloud blob contents. It's essentially the data, but it also has some metadata in it, and it allows you to actually iterate over the parts of the blob, if you will. We rely on WinRT here, and this is the only thing I'm really going to touch on WinRT. You will notice that we're storing this in a WinRT buffer. We're going to need that in order to display it in the UI. But we call flush async. That's, you know, like right through to media, in this case a memory buffer. But we're returning that, and that turns into a PPL task. So one of the things we did in 2010, and we did for WinRT, was specifically to mask or sort of shim, if you will, iasync operation and other interfaces like that with PPL tasks, which allows you to compose them sequentially and in parallel with tasks that are not WinRT tasks and, you know, other WinRT tasks very, very in a very straightforward manner, similar to how what you can do in .NET. And then once the flush is done, then we're really done. And all we need to do is set the UI to display the image that we have already downloaded from the blob storage. Okay, let's take a look at, and then we just wait for exceptions down here. That's a minor detail. If we take a look at the server side, here we don't have any state in the service, so we're going to just go with a simple way of putting the handlers in line in the onInitialize function. And we have two handlers here. We have put and we have get, right? Put was the upload. We're going to invoke that once for each file. And then we have get, which is the stitch the thing together and tell me where you put the results. Okay, so what do we do in put? Well, we pull out headers from the message. We're not using a URI tokenizer here because the data comes in headers instead. Once we have the data, we call this function called upload user image. That's the thing that takes the body of the message, which is an image, and stores it on a local disk file somewhere. So we're not relying on blob storage for the components of the image. And then we just have some error handling down here. And we're really done in many ways with the upload request because all that code is happening there. All that logic is happening in that function. All right, if we go to the get handler, we'll see a little bit more complex code, eventually at least. We are in here because the stitching together, the upload and then stitching, was orchestrated entirely for us on the client. So we know now that all the files are there. And so we just call this function, which we're going to go take a look at, and that will do all the stitching for us. All right, so if we look at that, we'll find that we do a bunch of stuff that has to do with just sort of bookkeeping. We quickly try to move on to stitching the images. This is a DLL that we got from Microsoft Research that does the sort of the magic behind that. We didn't put that together ourselves. And it just operates on a bunch of input files and an output file name, and it just puts everything together, produces a file on disk for us. And we're going to use that file on disk to upload it to blob storage, and that's what this share image function will do for us. Go ahead. So here, we look for some more headers. We still have the message around, so we're going to pull more data out of the headers. We're going to construct the image file name. That's the name on disk that we have. We're going to rely on standard IOStream file IO here. And we're going to, if we go down a little bit here, we're going to do things that are very similar to what we did on the client. We're going to create these blob client and blob container objects, which are local objects. But unlike the client, where we know that the server has already created the blob for us when we get to that code, here we're actually going to have to create the container. It may not exist. If it does exist, it's a no-op. So it's an idempotent operation. But we also need to set the container to public access. And that's the magic behind making the thing available when we tweeted it, right? So that anybody can see it. Blob storage is typically private by default unless you set the access control list to be something else. And in this case, we're setting it to fully public. Anybody in the world can see it. All right. Once we've created a container, we can then create a blob object based on that container, and we can just put the data into the blob. That's all you have to do, right? Done. And once that finishes, all that's really left to do is wait for any exceptions that may happen, and then send OK back with the file name. And we're done. So fairly small amounts of code to do a somewhat complex operation, at least from a interaction perspective. We were orchestrating multiple concurrent uploads and, you know, timing that with when they had all finished, we then did the stitching together and, you know, bringing data back, sending data up with fairly minimal amount of code. So to summarize, before we go to questions, we've talked about asynchronous I/O. We've talked about how it's important for both UI responsiveness and server scalability that it is that the I/O is asynchronous. We have HTTP, TCP, file I/O libraries that are asynchronous. We've talked about serialization. We've talked primarily about JSON. We talked about how you access Azure services, existing services like Service Bus. We didn't show that, but that's also available. Azure storage. We've not uploaded anything to run in Azure because that unfortunately takes a little bit of time. But those applications, both for the Blackjack server and for the image station, were running. Those are Casablanca services running in Azure. And we talked about cross-platform and how important we believe that cross-platform is for C++ and the C++ community in general. Download Casablanca. How many have already downloaded and looked up Casablanca here? So a handful, OK? It's worth trying out. It's on MSDN DevLabs. There should actually be a slash between com and DevLabs. Sorry about that. There's a ton of information about Azure and about REST and about, you know, all these things on MSDN, obviously. I encourage you to take a look at the VC++ blog. And obviously a lot of information if you want to know more about block blobs and page blobs and all those things on the Azure portal, developer portal. Please submit session evaluations, not just for this session, but for other sessions. While you're here, it's important to us. We have some related sessions, one about performance. We'll talk, Jim Radigan will talk about vectorization and about AMP and about PPL. On Friday, Herb Sutter will talk about the future of C++. That would be a great session, I'm sure. We also want to encourage you to consider, we're doing some developer experience studies during build, and if you have an interest in participating in that, we encourage you to doing that. It's tomorrow and Thursday, two different sessions, I hope you have an interest and a chance to participate in that. And with that, I apologize for running over a little bit. We only have a little bit of time left for questions. Arthur and I will stay here as long as you guys want to ask questions, but it is 6:43, and if you have other things to do at this late hour, then please do so. Yes. Yeah, so the question was about how do we generate dynamic HTML in C++. And frankly, even though the demo was doing that, we don't see that as a huge scenario for C++, frankly. There's so much utility in the existing, you know, in PHP and in ASP.NET and so on and so forth, that we think there's a sweet spot for C++ is going to be heavy computationally intensive services or extremely performance sensitive services. And we don't really see dynamic HTML generation as a big scenario for us, so we're not going to probably invest a lot in that, in this project at least. Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, so the question was about Linux, and why are we even bothering mentioning Linux?
I've seen the charts too.
Yeah. We do believe that cross-platform for C++ is a core strength of the language, right? So first of all, we need to make sure that what we're building can be cross-platform. This is going to be released as open source software, and we want to make sure that others, even if we don't take it to all the various platforms, somebody can, and that we have not designed it in a way that prevents that from happening. Okay, so that's one reason. The other one is that you can rent a Linux instance in Azure, right? So Linux is a Azure, it's a cloud platform for us, and we want to support that. So that's another reason, but they're both complementary, right? We actually have a business idea about supporting Linux on the server side, but also it's just like if we're not cross-platform, we're not really modern C++ in some ways, and we really believe that that's important for the credibility of that and integrity of the story.
The other part of the question has to do with, I suspect this is pretty blazingly fast on a server.
Yes. Well, I don't have. First of all, we're not at the stage where we're only at the stage where we're starting to look at sort of tuning for performance, and we frankly have not anything that we don't have any numbers that we can. First of all, that I have off the top of my head, and that we can sort of say this is where we're going to wind up. Casablanca is available. You can do your own benchmarking if you want to. Do it with the knowledge that we have not started tuning it yet. But obviously, C++ performance is more than about just raw speed. It's also about memory footprint to a great extent, right? And one of the issues with a lot of the VM-based environments is that they require a lot of memory in the way that C++ doesn't, which means that you need more servers, you need more energy, you spend more money. So there are many dimensions to performance, and scalability is obviously a very important one too. Keep that in mind, that we haven't started tuning for raw performance yet. We think that our memory footprint is good just, because it's C++. Okay.
You mentioned early on in the talk that currently the support is only on the Windows side, is only for Windows 7 and Windows 8. But yes. You were considering adding support for XP.
On XP. Yeah.
So part of the question is this partially because there's currently the limitation of Visual Studio 2012 with all the associated libraries not being able to produce XP?
The question about XP, why are we not supporting XP yet? It's really more about resources on an incubation project. We think it is more important to. The reason that we took this out as an incubation project on DevLabs was that we wanted to get early user feedback. That is the number one priority, right? And so that's one of the reasons we haven't started on performance yet is that it doesn't have anything to do with user feedback, right? We want to make sure that the APIs are useful, that they're productive, et cetera. And spending resources on an XP version of this, which would have to be a separate version because right now we're sitting on top of the Vista thread pool, for example. So XP is a separate effort. It's just expending resources right now in a stage of the project where it's not useful to do so because it doesn't get us more feedback earlier. right? And so that's why I'm sort of saying we're considering doing it later. But we are acutely aware of the importance of XP to the community of Microsoft developers. Let me just say that.
I kind of assumed that
yes.
You were aware of that.
Yes.
I was just wondering if it was just when the basically the XP build capability arrives with Visual Studio 24, that's just a matter of taking the switch for itself.
It's more than that, but it is it is really about. To support XP, we need to have a version that uses the XP thread pool. That's pretty much it. It's fairly straightforward port, but it's going to be a separate effort. So, yeah.
This pretty much looks like you're remapping the WCF on a native layer.
Yeah.
So there is actually, WCF is so much more.
Actually, but you had mentioned it could, actually, Casablanca is REST, but
yes.
It could be, so
it could
also
be
WebSocket, it could also
yes.
be NetDCP.
Yes, so there is a SOAP, there is native SOAP support in Windows Server, at least, I think on the client also. Called Windows Web Services. We've focused on REST because we think that is like the 80% solution. That's the 80% problem at least, right? And so SOAP requires more because of the richness and the, particularly in metadata in SOAP, supporting SOAP requires a lot more tooling to be productive because you don't want to edit that big, WSDL document yourself. You want somebody to do that for you. And you want that same tool to spit out all the skeleton code for your services too, right? And just given where REST and SOAP are in relation to each other in terms of usage, we have a laser sharp focus on REST. And until there's a huge demand for modern C++ support for, for SOAP-based programming, we'll probably stick with REST just because of the bang for the buck. WCF sits on top of .NET and leverages the richness of the .NET platform.
That's exactly yes. the bad thing, that WCF sits on top
of it. I understand, but its design leverages the richness of the platform in a way that is hard to do in C++, right? Because we don't have reflection in the richness, right? And we don't have, runtime code emission and so on and so forth, right? So designing a C++ SOAP interface, which we wouldn't be the first to do anyway, right? Would probably not wind up looking a lot like WCF. It wouldn't be attribute based. It wouldn't have the same design at all. It would solve the same problem in much the same way, but it would probably look very much different, I think. In the same way, if you look at the REST support for in WCF, it's all attribute based too. Whereas we're actually you're hooking up. You're creating listeners yourself and to do the routing, and you're hooking up handlers for each method rather than doing it based on attributes.
It's just a little bit scary that you can actually create REST services in so much ways. You can use Web API, you can use Plain MVC, you can use WCF, you can use Casablanca.
Yep.
Scary.
Okay. Well, our focus. So our focus here is building modern C++, really leveraging C++, not making it look like COM, not making it look like a .NET transplant, but making it look like, if all you knew was modern was C++ 11, it might, and you designed a REST framework, it might look something like this, right? That's what we're trying to accomplish.
Do you have any built-in support for cookies or proxies at this
point? No and yes. So we don't do cookies yet, but that's straightforward.
Yeah.
And proxy support we do have.
Straightforward meaning that you're not going to do it, you have no plans of doing that, or straightforward is just...
Straightforward in the sense of we're not prioritizing it because it's not something where we have a lot of user feedback type of questions, right? We'll support cookies. But it's not, a big design space, in my opinion, therefore we don't need to get a lot of user feedback on it, so we're not putting it in early. So unless it disables scenarios and prevents you, blocks you from even doing anything with it, then you know it doesn't help us at this stage.
So the proxy support that you guys have, is it just like a manually configured one, or is there any hack file?
It's programmatic.
Right? It's programmatic. We also have an API support, so you can create a proxy object, you can associate it with a client. In some ways, it's similar with a .NET API.
Yeah. So there's nothing. We're not trying to build a platform. We're trying to build just sort of libraries on top of existing platforms, and so it's all programmatic. And it's very obviously in WinRT, we're sitting on top of a very rich HTTP client stack. So it does the proxy. You don't even notice the proxying. If you supply all the data that you need, it just happens, right? Same thing with client-side certs, right? It just happens. It pops up. The stack underneath us will pop up the dialog that asks you which cert to use, et cetera, right? So we don't even have to get involved. On Windows 7 and Windows 8 desktop, it's a little bit more involved because we have to, we have to have a programmatic way of setting that up. Any other questions? Okay. It's late.
Okay.
I think they're giving stuff away in 5 minutes.
Yeah, but the line is long.
Yes.
Thank you.
I hope.